Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of A Fireside Chat. This is your host, Lance White, also known sometimes as the Zany Mystic. Tonight's guest hardly needs an introduction. Stan Friedman is known as one of the top researchers of ufology today. But for those of you who are just finding out about this stuff, I'll tell you that Stan received his BS and MS degrees in physics from University of Chicago in 1955. I was but a five-year-old at the time, and 1956, where Carl Sagan was a classmate. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, TRW, Aerojet General Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas on such advanced, highly classified, eventually canceled projects as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and nuclear power plants for space. That's quite a lot of fission material there. Since 1967, Friedman has lectured on the topic of UFOs at more than 600 colleges and over 100 professional groups in 50 states, 9 provinces, England, Italy, Germany, Holland, France, Finland, Brazil, Australia, Korea, Mexico, Turkey, Argentina, and Israel. Often referred to as the father of Roswell, Stan was the first to investigate the incident beginning in 1978. He has been investigating UFO incidents since the mid-1950s. A frequent guest on Coast to Coast AM is where I'm sure you've all heard him many times. I'm delighted to finally welcome Stan to the show tonight. Hi, Stan. How are you?
I'm great. Of course I'm great.
Well, we only have 5 minutes left. You've done so much in your life already that it takes 45 minutes just to introduce you.
Well, time passes slowly when you're having fun.
Exactly. Well, you've had such a fascinating and rich background to explore. You can talk about whatever you'd like, but for our listeners, maybe you could just fill us in on how you your interest in and connection to ufology developed.
Well, I call it ufology, like geology and biology. Sounds
okay.
More scientific that way.
All right.
Oh, it was very straightforward. I'm a cheapskate. I was ordering books from a discount book place in New York. I needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping. This was back in 1958. I was a young nuclear physicist with General Electric on a very large aircraft nuclear propulsion program. We were only spending $100 million that year.
No.
3,500 people full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists.
Wow.
Anyway, I needed one more book. So there was the book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Air Force Captain Edward Ruppelt, who had headed the Air Force Project Blue Book in the early 50s. And the Air Force was a co-sponsor of our program, and I figured, I didn't have an opinion about flying saucers, but this guy ought to know what he's talking about. And the Air Force, if these things are real and they use nuclear power, would certainly help our program.
Mm-hmm.
And besides which, it was only a buck marked down from $2.95 for a hardcover book.
Wow.
And it was costing me nothing because shipping would have been that great for the other books I had ordered. So what the heck? So I read the book. It intrigued me. It didn't convince me, but it intrigued me. I shared it with a neighbor. Charlie was 10 years older than I was. He was an engineer. He was more impressed than I was. Well, we each went off our own direction, and I went out to California after ANP. I could see the light on the wall. It was going to be canceled, and it was 16 months later. And in California, I found a good librarian. I read about 15 more books. Some of them were trash. If I'd read them first, I'd have probably read no more. And then a turning point was finding at the University of California, Berkeley Library, a copy of a privately published version of Project Blue Book Special Report Number 14. Now, in the first place, it hadn't been mentioned in any of these 15 books. In the second place, I was in data heaven. It was chock full of graphs and charts and tables and data on 3,201 sightings.
Wow.
Categorizations and quality evaluations. I'm trying to figure out why didn't anybody mention this report. And cross comparisons between unknowns and knowns and all this sort of thing. But what shook me up was the guy who had this privately published, he was a PhD down at Los Alamos, and there was no freedom of information back then, but he'd caught the press release in 1955 about this study and managed by doing a lot of pushing to get a copy and then reproduced it. The Secretary of the Air Force in the press release said, quote, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Well, that took care of things, except because I was looking at the data. Holy cow, he was lying through his teeth.
Uh-huh.
The unknowns weren't 3%. They were 21.5%.
Wow.
They weren't the ones for which there wasn't enough data. There was a separate category for them, 9.3%, insufficient information. They did a quality evaluation. The better the quality of the sighting, because of the background of the observer, the duration of observation, circumstances, etc., the more likely to be an unknown.
Mm.
They asked the question, an obvious question. You sort and sift all this data, and incidentally, only 1.5% were listed as psychological aberrations, a nice way of saying crackpot cases. Well, as a nuclear physicist, I have to point out that the American Physical Society, to which I and most physicists belong, says 2% of the papers submitted to it for publication by physicists are crackpot papers.
Yeah.
So there are more crackpots associated with physics than with flying saucers, that would tell you. Anyway, what they found when they cross-compared unknowns versus knowns on the basis of color, size, shape, speed, that sort of stuff, the probability that the unknowns were just missed knowns was less than 1%.
Wow.
And the greater the quality, the more likely to be unexplainable. 35%. I should use the Air Force terminology, only 35%. It's always only when they talk about unknowns. And, you know, if I was looking for a cure for cancer and I told you, eh, I guess there isn't one, only 35% of the best drugs we tried worked, you'd say, what do you mean there's no cure? Give me the one that works. I don't care about
right.
all the ones that don't, you know.
Right.
I'm a nuclear guy. Sure, there's only a couple of isotopes that will sustain a nuclear chain reaction. What do I care about the ones that won't? Give me the ones that will, you know. So that one shook me up. I mean, I was working under security, and I was accustomed to sometimes you had to sort of skirt the truth.
Hmm.
But outright lying was something new to me. I've seen a lot of it since, and as a matter of fact, on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com, I've got a paper, Government UFO Lies, and I don't discriminate. I have lies from the CIA and the FBI and the Air Force and the NSA. There's an awful lot of lying going on.
Wow.
And so, you know, it was an education to me. And then, you know, I was worried about, I didn't want to speak out publicly. I was working under security. I read a lot of books. That's one thing. I joined APRO and NICAP, the two big groups back then. They don't exist anymore. And I only went public because Frank Edwards, a newsman in Indianapolis in the mid-60s, wrote a best-selling book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business. And Frank, because I'd gotten to know him when I lived in Indianapolis working on another canceled program for General Motors, I was working now for Westinghouse. That program got canceled, too, nuclear rocket engines. But anyway, I contacted Frank and said, I want to go public. You got any ideas? He knew everybody as a traveling newsman, and he was active in NICAP and stuff. And he gave me some names, and one of them was a producer at a radio show in Pittsburgh at KDKA, one of the oldest big stations in the country. And I called them. The radio show was appropriately called Contact Incidentally, which I think is kind of funny. Remember the movie?
Yeah, Carl Sagan wrote a book on that, didn't he?
That's right. It was made into a movie with Jodie Foster.
Yeah, excellent movie.
And I liked the movie a lot better than the book myself. But,
yeah, me too.
Anyway, I called Contact, and it was, even though I worked for Westinghouse, it was one of those, don't call us, we'll call you. Well, less than a month later, I get a call at 6:30. Could I be on their show at 7 o'clock? They'd had a cancellation. They probably had called six other people. I live near the station, so I did it. All a coincidence, serendipity, I guess. A gal at work who was a technician at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab heard me on the show, and their book review club was reading Frank's book.
Wow.
Saucer Serious Business. She asked if I would give a lecture about UFOs to the book review club. So in her living room, I gave my first talk, Flying Saucers Are Real. And I did that show many times after that, and I did what I call the chicken and peas circuit. You know, everybody wants free programs. And then in another bit of serendipity, only one of two times when I was driving into work, Westinghouse was outside town. I lived near downtown. I was with Joanne, a supervisor at Westinghouse, PhD from Carnegie Mellon, and we were talking, and I said, gee, I'd really like to speak at Carnegie Mellon University. And she said, well, talk to the dean. And I said, oh, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. So I called him, and he was be delighted to have me speak. And he wanted a morning date, 11 o'clock in the morning, sort of a assembly program, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to take half a day off work at least. He asked me, how much do you want? And I said, oh, how about $100? I thought he'd cut me down to 50, you know. And then because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in the series, $1,500,
$1,800. Oh.
But the talk went over very well, and he wrote a nice letter to the agent that he booked the other people through. And they booked me at the Engineering Society of Detroit. And that was a real breakthrough for me, not just because I got $300 for it, but they were sold out for 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, and there wasn't one negative question. And, you know, the Engineering Society of Detroit is not a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes. They're sharp engineers and so forth. So that one and a whole bunch of other technical groups to whom I spoke, Los Alamos, I spoke to the American Nuclear Society section there. They had 500 people. And so it was the enthusiastic response of my professional peers, not the excitement of the nut societies, that when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space business, as it did in 1970, I went full-time ufologizing, I'll make up another word.
I like that one.
And I've done some consulting. I moved here in 1980, Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, which is the capital of the picture province of New Brunswick. We're east of Maine. We're 4 hours ahead of California. And, you know, it's a great place to live because on August 27th, they declared it Stanton Friedman Day.
Wow.
Because of my work on nuclear energy, I worked at a local nuclear power plant as a consultant for a bit. And my notoriety about UFOs, I don't know quite what that means. This was after I'd been on the Larry King show, and there'd been an article in the paper, and I guess there aren't many people from Fredericton that turn up on Larry King. But and the mayor likes the fact that I promote the town, and that he's a promoter of the town. Actually, it's the capital, and it's the home of the University of New Brunswick, which is the oldest English-language university in all of Canada.
Wow.
It's a great, great place to live and raise a family. I mean, I moved here from Northern California, Hayward. You know where that is.
Oh, yeah, and I used to live in the Bay Area.
Yeah, and I get people saying, how could you live back there, Stan? Don't you miss California? And I said, well, yeah, it took a while to get used to not having earthquakes and horrible traffic and miserable smog.
Yeah.
You know, drive-by shootings and stuff like that, but I learned to do without those.
Yeah, you suffer through it.
Yeah, yeah, and so I've lived there 27 years, been very glad. And the thing is, the kind of research I do, mostly I've been to 20 archives. My book, Top Secret Magic, is about the Majestic 12 documents, and I found very useful information at the library of the University of New Brunswick. It's a mile from my house.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, that's kind of neat to be able to do your research and not have to go far. It's also neat when you've got a daughter going to college and she can live at home.
Yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
Isn't Canada a little bit more liberal about their approach to the subject as well?
Well, I don't know. The town has always been good to me. I did a weekly science commentary, including a few UFO shows, for 6 years here for CBC Radio. And, They know me, so
yeah.
The newspaper people know me. And
well,
they
I
know
think
they
the world knows you by now.
Well, yeah, when I always try to encourage people. I say, look, yes, there is a fear of ridicule, but I've given over 700 lectures. I've only had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk. And you get that many if you talk about sports, religion,
oh, yeah.
Politics, hockey here, for example. You know, so, and I've never had an egg or a tomato thrown at me, and I get well-received, I think, because I put the facts and data out on the table. I don't make them up as I go along.
Yeah, and you have a scientific approach, too, which appeals
yeah.
to many of us that are lean towards the left brain. The top secret Majestic 12 documents, is that a project, I know that, is that still continuing on in some other new form or hybrid, do you know?
Well, there's no question, that some of the documents are fraudulent, and I point that out in my book, but I don't care about the fraudulent ones. It's perfectly natural for intelligence agencies to flood the market with garbage when good stuff gets out.
Right, right.
And hope the garbage will stick to the good stuff, you know.
Right.
I'm sure that the name was changed. That's standard practice. When a code name gets out, you change it.
Right.
And I think certainly that there is such a group. And remember, there needs to be, well, think of intelligence. You know these big Western wagon wheels, you know, with the spokes and the rim around
mm-hmm.
the edge? Think of one of those without the rim. You got all the spokes going into the center, but the spokes don't touch each other. So you need somebody to serve as a kind of central clearinghouse for several different kinds of data. One is when you examine the wreckage of crash saucers.
Mm-hmm.
Another is when you get scientific measurements of the flight capability of saucers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instruments on airplanes chasing UFOs, radar systems, mm-hmm. and how quickly did it turn, and how did the color change when it turned. And, you know, we have many, many reports of pilot sightings, military pilots. As a matter of fact, there's a new book, Shoot Them Down, by Frank Fascino, Jr. I wrote the foreword and the epilogue. It just came out within the last couple months. And the kicker is that instructions were given to military pilots in 1952. Shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so. That's the God's honest truth. And as a matter of fact, the head of the American Rocket Society, Dr. Farnsworth, wrote a letter to President Truman
mm-hmm.
saying he didn't think that was a good idea.
To say the least.
And an Air Force general admitted that we had scrambled jets more than 300 times.
Wow.
This is what he said in 52, mind you.
Oh, my.
And Frank went through the New York Times from 1950 to 56 looking for airplane crashes. There were over 220 military airplane crashes and in the United States. And the interesting thing is that words like disintegrated and disappeared were used.
Oh.
And those are sort of peculiar words. And three of the pilots who crashed each had more than 100 missions in Korea before they came home, and there were MiGs chasing them over there. You got to be a pretty good pilot, in other words, to survive all that. And yet, here they come back without any MiGs, and they crash.
Great.
And I have heard seven different stories of more planes going up than came back chasing UFOs.
Wow.
And so this is part of the whole question here. How much is the government holding back? It's very hard to get at crash reports. When I've been to the archives, I've been to 20 archives over the years. And
now, what about personal anecdotes from people who are high up in the military?
Well, the very high ups don't talk very much, although in the case of Roswell, I was able to get the testimony of a retired general, Thomas Jefferson Dubose, and he's in the pictures with General Roger Ramey, taken in Ramey's office in Fort Worth, Texas, on July 8, 1947, Roswell stuff. And I managed, I'm a pretty good detective when I work at it, and I managed to locate General Dubose and visited with him at his home in Florida. He was in his 80s, and he told me how he took the call from Raimi's boss after the press release went out about the Roswell wreckage being recovered, and it was being sent to higher headquarters, and Fort Worth was the home of the 8th Air Force, and the 509th in Fort Worth, and Roswell was part of the 8th, and DuBose is in the pictures with General Raimi, head of the 8th Air Force, with some of the phony wreckage, that balloon stuff, radar reflectors and stuff. It wasn't what was picked up out on the ranch in Roswell. And anyway, DuBose told me he took the call from General Raimi's boss in Washington, General McMullins, two-star, that telling him, giving him three orders. One, I want you to get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it. I mean, here's a press release goes out saying we've recovered the wreckage of a flying saucer. Wow. Uh-huh. There'd been over 1,000 sightings in the previous 2 weeks, you understand.
Wow.
So people were laying back waiting, what's going on here, you know. The second order was to send some of that wreckage up here today when it comes in with one of your colonel couriers. And three, I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Raimi. He was the head of the 8th Air Force. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing?
Wow.
No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, and they knew each other, he does it. He doesn't argue about it. People get surprised when I say that. This is the military. Right after the war, these guys were West Pointers. McMullen was a West Pointer. DuBose was a West Pointer. Raimi was a West Pointer. And the head of Roswell, Colonel Blanchard, was a West Pointer. And so the boss gives orders. You follow them.
Exactly.
Major Jesse Marcel, only a major, was not West Point, but he was the intelligence officer for the most elite military group in the world. 509th dropped the two nuclear weapons on Japan.
Whoa.
They dropped two more in the Pacific in 1946 in Operation Crossroads. So this was a very special group of people. And I've had people say, oh, I'll bet Colonel Blanchard was banished to Siberia for putting out that stupid press release. I wish to point out that he got four more promotions. He was a four-star general when he died of a massive heart attack at the Pentagon when he was the vice chief of staff of the Air Force.
Wow.
And he had been chief of operations for the Strategic Air Command, under which there were a few thousand megatons of, or hundreds of megatons of nuclear weapons. This is not a nut. This is not a Dr. Strangelove.
No.
And there was a huge, on his death, incidentally, a big ceremony at the Air Force Academy and so forth. But what I'm saying is you get people saying cockamamie things. They haven't talked to any of these people. Of course, I talked to Major Marcel, and incidentally, there's another new book out by Major Marcel's son, who is himself a colonel, just got back a year ago from serving in, of all places, Iraq. At age 68, he was called back in. Now, he's not only a colonel in the reserve, he got 40 years connection with the military, but he was a medical doctor, a flight surgeon, a helicopter pilot, put in 225 combat hours in Iraq. This is not somebody's fool. This is not somebody who hated the government, make up stories. He handled some of that wreckage. And his book, for which I wrote the foreword, is The Roswell Legacy, telling his dad's story. He was there in July 7th, 1947, when his dad came home and showed some of the wreckage that he had picked up out at the ranch.
Wow.
So, it's hard. Now, I should point out that, unfortunately, on the Peter Jennings mockumentary, as I call it, Seeing is Believing, February 24th, 2005, they interviewed Jesse Marcel, Jr. They didn't bother to say that he was a medical doctor, a colonel, a helicopter pilot. I think those go toward credibility.
Absolutely.
So I've been working on this a long time. I believe in finding the people as much as you can. I've been in Jesse Marcel Jr.'s home and in his dad's home, and was the first to talk to his dad. And I just read an account today. I don't even know where it was, on the Internet someplace, where somebody was given the story about Roswell. And they say in 1978, Major Marcel came forward to tell his story. Make it sound like he was running around, hey, listen to me. Well, he didn't come forward. I went to him because I was at a television station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was doing three interviews, supposedly, for a lecture I was given that night at Louisiana State University.
Uh-huh.
And I'd done the first two, and a third reporter was nowhere to be found. Now, there were no cell phones back then in 78. And the station manager's giving me coffee, and he's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed. He knew the person who brought me to the station from the university. And out of the blue, you know, he's wondering, where the heck is that reporter? Out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And brilliant investigator that I am, I said, who's he? And he says, oh, he handled wreckage of one of those sauces you were interested in when he was in the military. What?
Wow.
I picked up my teeth, and, you know, what do you know about him? He lives over in Houma, Louisiana. I had never heard of Houma, Louisiana. I've been there since, but it's a pretty good-sized town, a city, actually. But we're old ham radio buddies. He's a great guy. You ought to talk to him. And then the reporter showed up. So I did my thing with her, and I did my lecture that night. We had a great crowd. The next day from the airport, I called information. Yeah, there was a Jesse Marcel in Houma, so I spoke with him. He told me a story. He didn't have the exact date. He was the intelligence officer for the 509th. He was eating on a Sunday at the officers' club when they get a call from the sheriff's office. Some rancher had come in with some really strange material and says there's a lot of it out there.
Mm.
Jesse checks it out, talks to his boss, who, after he describes it, you know, nothing that I've ever seen before. The boss, Colonel Blanchard, tells him to take one of the counterintelligence corps guys with him and go check it out. Now, they had to follow the rancher to get out to the ranch because it's not on a road. And they didn't have any GPS back then. I know
right.
Somebody asked me, why didn't they use GPS? Because they didn't have it. And why hadn't the rancher called into town? Because he didn't have a phone or electricity.
Yeah.
He's out in the boonies.
Yeah.
So they go out there. They see the wreckage. They stay overnight in their sleeping bags, see the wreckage the next morning, bring a small amount of it back, and tell how there's an awful lot of it left. And Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, gives two orders. One is to Jesse, get this up to our headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas, on the way to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That's where captured enemy equipment goes.
Uh-huh.
And the second order he gives is to the base public information officer, Walter Hout, to put out a press release. So naturally they both followed orders, and that led to evening papers having articles about Roswell from Chicago West. The press release went out about noon New Mexico time, which was too late for the East Coast. And the biggest one is the Los Angeles Herald Express, which doesn't exist anymore, you understand. But Army finds flying saucer. That's the whole width on the front page.
Wow.
General thinks it's radar weather gadget. General Ramey, 4 hours after the release went out, followed orders and explained it away. Just a radar reflector weather balloon combination.
Right.
And, of course, it's kind of interesting that we've had two explanations. First, Army finds flying saucer. Second, just a radar reflector weather balloon combination. The third didn't come out until 1994. It was a mogul, super secret mogul balloon train. That's one of those lies.
Yeah.
There was nothing secret about mogul except the purpose of it. None of the technology was secret.
Hmm.
About 20 balloons, standard, normal weather balloons, not these big teardrop-shaped things that you often see on television.
Mm-hmm.
20 balloons at 20-foot intervals, so you got over 400 feet high with some sonobuoys and radio equipment and stuff like that. And, you know, big, awkward thing. And the wreckage was explained away, in other words, just a weather balloon. And fortunately, at the time that this all broke, there were no pictures taken in Roswell, only in Ramey's office in Fort Worth. And I'm sure pictures were taken out at the ranch because a lot of people were sent out there to collect as much debris as possible. It covered an area 3/4 mile long, a few hundred yards wide. And yet these counterintelligence corps guy that was sent out with Major Marcel, all of a sudden, after 20 years of denial, oh, yeah, I remember that. It was just a weather balloon and covered an area 20 feet square, easily fit in one vehicle, huh? 20 feet square. Now, even the denial article in the Roswell paper on the 9th of July said 250 yards in diameter. 20 feet square versus 250 yards.
That's a little different.
Yeah, a lot different. And if that's all there had been, that would easily fit in one vehicle. The rancher would have brought it into town,
right,
and there would have been no need for Marcel and Cabot, the counterintelligence corps guy, to go out there.
Right.
And it's out in the middle of nowhere. It's a torturous path. I've been there, but people always want to go out there. You know, I was at Roswell's 60th anniversary and 50th anniversary and several in between, and I say, what do you want to go there for? There's nothing there.
Right.
Well, I want to be where it happened. Well, there's 10,000 square miles close to Roswell. It looks exactly like it. And, of course, then I add, you know, your cell phones don't work out there, and there's no AAA and no McDonald's and no gas stations, and there are rattlesnakes and scorpions. That discourages some of them. But Roswell, and I have a book out. It's listed on the website, www.stantonfriedman.com, called the crash at Corona.
Uh-huh.
That's the small town that's closest to the crash site. Much smaller than Roswell. I mean, Roswell was only 25,000, but it was the home of the 509th. Corona, well, yeah, there were some people who lived there. I think the population was about 700 back then, but not a big town. But my book, Crash at Corona, goes into that, and it's listed on the website as is Top Secret Magic. And my new book,
yes,
Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, by myself and Kathleen Martin, who's Betty's niece. She has all the tapes.
That's an interesting book.
Yeah, it is.
What do you think makes... I've been reading it. I'm not quite finished with it yet, but it's a fascinating story, and it's well-written. What do you think makes the Betty and Barney Hill case so unique?
Well, there's several things. First, it's the first abduction that got carefully investigated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the first abduction.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was the story. Obviously, Betty and Barney, had no preceding story to tell one like that one, you know, to serve as a model. Secondly, the character of the people. Betty was a social worker, after all. Barney worked for the post office, but was on the governor's civil rights commission. He was very well respected and very active in civil rights. Third, and probably most important, the hypnotist was Dr. Benjamin Simon. Now, he had been in the military. He had been a colonel. He even had a hospital with 3,000 beds treating what they used to call shell shock war veterans. Today,
mm-hmm,
we'd say suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And he had worked out a technique. I mean, the experience took place in 61, the hypnosis in 64. But right after the war, he worked out a technique for using medical hypnosis to get the patient deep under hypnosis and to be able to have them relive the experience that got him into trouble in the first place.
Mm.
And he was very good at what he did. And it turns out that if you can get people to, I think it's called abreacting, they can work through their problems, and you can have guys who can't walk, you know, get back to their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very good. He hypnotized them each separately, induced amnesia after each sentence. Session. This went on for months, and the emotional intensity was extraordinary. And he said it was greater than that of any of the shell shock war veterans he worked with on occasion. He had to stop a couple of sessions. He was afraid they couldn't make their way through it. They were terror stricken at parts of the experience. I mean, being taken on board against your will by aliens who obviously don't exist, but, you know, and who have the ability to make you do things you wouldn't otherwise do.
Yeah.
Kathleen and I were at the site where the abduction took place in Lincoln, New Hampshire, small town. And when you're there, you realize there's no way Barney would have driven off the main road. They were heading south from Montreal toward Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is on the coast between Maine and Massachusetts. There was no way in the world he would have gone off the main road to a secondary road and then taken another turn onto a dirt road.
Right.
It was clear he was being influenced, and the fact that their time that the had missing time of 2 hours, clearly an indication of the ability to control mental processes. What can I say? So, and it's interesting, and one of the things that's an important point in the book, Betty had dreams. They didn't know that they'd been abducted. They knew they had missing time because, hey, how come they got home 5 o'clock instead of 3 o'clock in the morning? You know, and their watches stopped, and there were a lot of other little details. But Betty had dreams, a bunch of dreams in the next couple of weeks about being, I'll say, kidnapped by strange beings. And Dr. Simon tried to get both of them to believe that what Barney recited was somehow absorbed from Betty's dreams. Rather than pushing them in the direction of a standard abduction case, and of course there wasn't one then, but, you know, the debunkers claim that, oh, those abductions, that's just because the hypnotist people like Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs, both of whom I consider very competent in doing what they're doing, they just shaped the story up to match their view of what would have happened. It didn't really happen. Well, here we have a hypnotist who's pushing him away from an abduction experience. Mm. And Kathleen did a comparative analysis between what Betty and Barney said under hypnosis and Betty's dreams. And it's clear that Barney wasn't saying the same thing. Their testimony backed up each other when they were in the same position, so to speak. You know, how many guys are on each side of them when they're taken on board the craft and that sort of thing. But certainly it wasn't dreams. Now, I'm fascinated by the fact that some people will say without a shred of evidence, well, there was a science fiction program on a few weeks before this. Barney must have watched that.
Oh,
well, he worked nights. They were both very busy in community activities. They didn't watch science fiction. Betty was a UFO buff. Yeah, she went to the library after their experience to look up an address for NICAP, sent them a letter, and had an investigator come out many days later, spent 6 hours with them. She wasn't a UFO buff. You know, and people make these things up.
Yeah, yeah.
And on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, you'll find my review of a book by Dr. Susan Clancy. Got her degree from Harvard. The book was published by Harvard University Press. And it's Abductions, Why People Come to Believe They've Been Kidnapped by Aliens. And she had worked with people with lost memory, false memory syndrome. Sexual abuse, supposedly, as children, you know.
Right, right.
And she said that the problem with that is you don't know whether the event took place or not. Why don't we work on something where we can be sure it didn't take place? Let's look at UFO abductions, starting with the assumption that they never happened, you understand. And she mentions the Betty and Barney Hill case, gets everything wrong. She mentions a whole bunch of other cases and gets everything wrong. So I have a review on my website pointing out factually what she says. Well, she had one case, the Allagash Four. There's a book about happenings in the Allagash, it's a region of Maine out in the woods. And she says there were two brothers, and it happened in the 60s, and they wrote a book about this experience. Well, the fact of the matter is there were four people involved, and it happened in the 70s, and they didn't write the book. I mean, those are just trivial details.
Yeah, right, right.
So, and yet she claims to have seen all the movies, read all the books, and there's no evidence for UFOs. She didn't mention my books, darn it. But
why do you think people are so quick to jump on the disinformation bandwagon?
I think it's a combination of things. I call it mostly, for smart people, the David Susskind syndrome. Remember David? He was a host.
Yeah.
When I was living in Southern California, I got a call back in 73, I think it was. There was a big wave of sightings. And I'd been very busy and lecturing and stuff. And this is before Roswell. Some people think that's what got me started. My first lecture was in 67. Anyway, Susskind's people call me, and they want to get a good abductee, so I get them Betty Hill. They wanted a good skeptic. I said, there aren't any, but here's how to reach Phil Klass, the late and not lamented by me, Phil Klass. They wanted a recent good case, the coin helicopter case in Ohio, for crewmen of a military helicopter. And they wanted me to send them all kinds of stuff. So I did all those things. And they brought me to New York for one night. And in the course of taping the show, David says, you know, this is off the air, I read the New York Times. There's nothing in there that says these things are real.
Oh,
so
geez.
The Susskind syndrome is that everybody agrees if flying saucers were real, that would be important. But if it were important, I would know about it because I take great pride in knowing what's important that's going on.
Uh-huh.
If I don't know about it, it isn't real, and I'm not going to waste my time on this kind of garbage.
Okay.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, you see.
You
can easily say there is no evidence when what you mean is, I don't know about any evidence.
Right, right.
And so I'm not going to bother to look for some. I mean, obviously, if there was anything there, I'd know about it. Same problem for some of the media people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the PhDs, the ancient academics and fossilized physicists that I referred to.
Yeah.
You know, a good example
narrow-mindedness.
Narrow-minded, lack of professional involvement.
Yeah, yeah. Curiosity.
And they don't understand how, because you have a PhD in, let's say, physics or astronomy, that doesn't mean you know anything about space travel.
Well, that's true.
My worst example was a Canadian professor. I'm a dual citizen of Canada and the United States. I can complain about both governments, you see. Dr. Campbell, 1941, thought it was nonsense to talk, as the science fiction writers did, of going to the moon. He'd show that was nonsense. He wrote a scientific paper, pages of equations. He set out to show how heavy would a rocket have to be to get a man to the moon and back. Bottom line, many equations, the rocket would have to weigh 1,000,000 tons.
Oh, jeez.
And even for me, that's too big. But you know what? 1969, we got three guys to the moon and back, still with a dumb old chemical rocket.
Yep.
Initial launch weight was 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million.
Wow.
When astronomers do calculations about space travel, they are almost invariably astronomically in error. That's not the only example. It's the worst one.
And yeah.
So I think one of the big reasons is, well, four. I usually give four reasons why the big shots of science and journalism haven't jumped on the pro-UFO bandwagon. First, it's ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
I check all my audiences. I normally cover five large-scale scientific studies. And after each one, I show a slide, describe what's in it, including, and I start with that Blue Book Special Report 14, which is a document I described before, and I didn't give its title because the government press release didn't say what the title was or who did it or where it was done, which is a little hard to believe, but that's what happened. I five studies, and after each one, I ask, how many people here have read this? If I'm lucky, I'll get 2%. So the first problem is ignorance of the data. I've talked to as many as 2,000 people at once, 1,000 engineers and scientists at once. I never get any more than a couple percent who've read any of the five studies. And yet the noisiest negativism comes from those who know the least about the subject.
Right, right.
The second problem is the laughter curtain, the fear of ridicule.
Right.
Most people believe in UFOs, but they believe most other people don't.
Right.
And so they don't want to report their sightings. They don't want to teach a course. They don't want to sponsor a PhD thesis. There have only been, I think it's 11 the last time I checked. The third problem I call ego. I've actually talked to a journalist who was insistent that if aliens were coming here, they'd have called a press conference and he would have been invited.
And
there was a Harvard professor of astronomy who said if aliens were coming here, they would certainly wish to talk to the National Academy of Sciences, of which he and his good friend Dr. Condon, who put out one of those five studies, were members. And the whole attitude was, well, they haven't asked for an appointment, they must not be coming here.
Right.
And the fourth problem, I mean, remembering that flying saucers finished the job that Copernicus started of taking man out of the center of the universe. You remember old Nicolaus Copernicus.
Mm-hmm.
1543, he let a book be published that he'd written before, in which he had the gall to suggest the Earth wasn't the center of the universe.
Ooh.
The sun was. The church was so upset, the book was banned for 300 years. This finishes the job. The sun isn't the center of the universe either.
Right.
And the fourth problem is a complete unwillingness to look at the technology, it's easy to say, it's impossible.
Right.
Well, what you really mean is, I don't know how to do that, but
right.
why should I? I don't know anything about aeronautics and astronautics. You know, they don't want to admit that. So in my lectures, I'll show pictures of nuclear rocket engines and talk about nuclear fusion. And that's important because every advanced civilization will learn about nuclear fusion because that's what powers the stars.
Ah.
We figured it out in 1938, actually before the first controlled nuclear chain reaction. So we figured it out. Fusion is important, and I would point out that when I worked on a fusion propulsion system more than 40 years ago, it turns out if you use the right stuff in the right way, kick particles out the back end of the rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a standard chemical rocket. 10 million times.
Wow.
Leading to Friedman's Law, technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. Now, that's important because in the Hill case, described and captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience,
mm-hmm.
I talk about the star map that Betty saw and that a wonderful woman named Marjorie Fish did, built models of our local neighborhood, beads on string up to 250 stars in a model. Anyway, the base stars of the patterns that were found, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, that's the constellation of Reticulum, the net in Latin, which I don't speak, but I did look it up. And those two stars, and you need a new perspective, they're only 39.2 light years from here, which is just down the street.
Okay.
But they're only an eighth of a light year apart from each other, which means they're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. We're out in the boonies.
Huh.
They got next door neighbors. In addition, from a planet around one looking at the other, it's visible all day long.
Wow.
You can directly observe planets around the other one.
Huh.
And, oh yes, another little detail. They're a billion years older than the sun.
Really?
A cool billion. So if progress comes from doing things differently, if they got a little head start over us, you know, maybe 500 years or 5 million years, something like
that. Right.
They're going to know some things we don't know. I mean,
most
just look
likely.
Back, you know, look back 100 years.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I'm staring at a computer here, and I started work in industry using a slide rule. And I said that to two classes that met together at the University of Detroit a couple years back. And I looked around. I didn't see any reaction, so I was clever enough to ask, any of you know what a slide rule is? Not one student in that class.
Oh, my.
And that was less than 50 years.
Wow.
So you get my point. That
yeah.
Things have changed enormously. This thing on my desk, which is not a new computer, it's only got a 20-gigabyte hard drive.
Well, that's all, eh?
Well, yeah. Well, my wife bought one with 200 gigabytes for family pictures, for goodness sake.
Well, you know, a lot of scientists are pushing for something that they call the event horizon.
Well, yeah, I'm not into theoretical physics because these guys aren't into experimental physics. Well, you know, I hear lots of talk about fourth-dimensional space-time warping, wormholes, black holes, white holes, and getting there before you leave, which,
yeah.
You know, time warping and stuff.
Yeah, Sagan used to talk about that all the time, billions of years.
Yeah, and I leave that to the theoretical guys.
Yeah.
I like nuclear fusion. I worked on nuclear fission rockets that we tested back in the 60s, and the biggest one, Los Alamos built, well, Westinghouse built some, and the Aerojet General built up in Sacramento built some. And the biggest one, Los Alamos built, less than 7 feet in diameter, power level 4,400 megawatts, which is twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam.
Jeez.
And that was tested in the 60s.
Well, it makes you wonder what they have now.
Well, the programs were canceled, like everything else I worked on, because they didn't have a mission for it. I was at a horrible meeting not that anybody was unpleasant, but NASA, the Space Nuclear Propulsion Office, had a meeting at Aerojet, and I happened to be there from Westinghouse. We were working on the shielding for the rockets. And at the meeting, the question was, what should we do with the nuclear rocket engine? Well, we could use it for Earth orbit, lunar orbit. We could use it as an upper stage to go to Mars. Maybe we could build a lunar base. They didn't know what they wanted to do with the thing.
Okay.
And if you don't know what you want, the money ain't going to stay there,
right,
man, because there are a lot of other people who know what they want to do.
Speaking of NASA, do you feel that NASA and some of the other space exploration agencies are being straightforward with the public?
No, not at all.
Tell us about that.
Well, I've talked to several astronauts, and, you know, people think NASA's just a civilian agency, and, Friedman, what do you mean that they're not into intelligence work? Of course they are. I worked on classified stuff for the companies I worked for NASA, and I've talked to enough astronauts to be convinced that plenty of stuff has been seen in deep space. Now, most of the guys are pretty careful. Gordon Cooper spoke out about his sightings. Deke Slayton spoke out about his sighting and when he was flying airplanes, and Gordon as well. Now, I knew one of the astronauts before he became an astronaut. We were both speaking in San Diego at a meeting of the American Nuclear Society, each chairing a session, and we got to talking. We spent 2 hours talking about UFOs.
Mm.
And I asked him, he bought copies of several of the documents I had with me, and because I was giving a talk sometime after that trip, and I asked him about the astronaut sightings. And the way he answered me, well, I didn't think there was anything that couldn't be explained. It made me so aware that he was probably under security and couldn't talk about it. And I had a clearance, but I certainly didn't have a need to know for what he knew.
Right.
And I had a friend, a PhD in physics, who talked to another astronaut, ran into the same experience, that they were pumping him, but were giving nothing back. And I found out more about those astronaut sightings in the Condon report after that. Then Bill Anders was his name. And it's strange that I had an invitation from the NASA people at North American Rockwell Downey, where they built the command module.
Mm-hmm.
They heard me talk at a McDonnell Douglas management club, and a guy comes up to me afterward, would you be willing to talk to our group? Sure. So I go over there. They take me on a tour. They take my picture with my hand on the Apollo 12 command module, which had come back from the moon and stuff. And it was all a one-way street. They wouldn't tell me anything, but they were asking questions like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And so NASA people are interested. There's movies from some of the shuttle missions which raise a lot of questions. Anybody who thinks that they're not holding back something doesn't understand how the system works.
Mm.
And I've had corroboration from people who've had top-secret clearances with them. I only had a Q clearance, which is sort of like a top secret, depending which agency nuclear stuff. But so, no, I don't think NASA's told us all it knows, but they're not the only ones. In my paper on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, you'll find a paper called Government UFO Lies.
Oh, good, good.
And this is from a whole bunch of agencies. In addition, you'll have my answers to the UFO why questions, W-H-Y, and, you know, like why the cover-up and why would aliens come here anyway and why don't they land on a White House lawn and, you know, the usual stuff.
Right.
And
what about the big one that there were some alien representatives that met with Eisenhower?
That story is, it's still in my gray basket, but William Moore, with whom I worked very closely on the Roswell story for a few years, Bill checked. You know, the excuse given for why he wasn't being seen was that a dentist had done some dental work on him and using anesthetics and stuff, and he was in no condition to talk to the press. Well, Bill found the wife of the dentist. The dentist was dead. This was supposedly back in the 50s, you understand.
Okay.
And the wife had no recollection of her husband treating the president. He checked the medical records. They keep very good records on you know, presidents.
Sure.
And there was nothing in there about him being treated on that day.
Oh, my.
Now, there would have been time for him to go over to Edwards Air Force Base and see some aliens. We, The work doesn't prove that he did.
Right.
It just makes it possible, conceivable, that it could have. And
right.
Ike, there's a whole book about Ike spies. And he was very intelligence agency conscious. And, you know, the briefing for him, briefing for the president-elect, Dwight D. Eisenhower, in 1952, November 18th, my book, Top Secret Magic, goes into this in detail, but Ike was one who was very conscious. He made all the choices about whether the U-2s would fly or not.
Huh.
Final choice rested in his hands.
Huh.
He, in World War II, knew that we had broken the German code, which was very important, Enigma codes.
Uh-huh.
It's nice to know where your enemy's going to be flying his airplanes, where his troops are, and all that stuff. But you got to be careful how that information is handled, because you don't want them to find out that you know, or they change the code.
Right, right.
And so Ike was very much into intelligence work, and knew how to keep a secret, let's put it that way.
Okay.
Of all the people who became president, Ike had had more involvement with highly classified work. Well, really, anybody else, including George Bush Sr., who'd been head of the CIA.
Wow.
Well, you know, look at Ike's history. And so the briefing for President-elect Eisenhower is very instructive. It says there was a crash at Roswell, that a group called Majestic 12 was established by President Truman. And some of your listeners are going to say, everybody knows those documents are fraudulent. Read my book. Or go to the website and read my update on Majestic 12.
Right.
And yes, there are phony MJ-12 documents out there, but there are real ones, too.
Yeah. And wasn't it Ike that warned us about the military-industrial complex?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're living that now, aren't we?
We seem to be. I mean, the reports out of Iraq would seem to indicate that some industrial complexes are making an awful lot of money and not doing all the things they're supposed to be doing.
Exactly. It's all going down to, you know, it's all being sorted out into the right hands.
Right.
Not the hands it's supposed to go into, but... So, well, you know, we're almost out of time. We can go on and on for hours. This is fascinating, Stan. Before we have to go, make sure that you mention your website and your new book as well.
Okay, the website is www.stantonfriedman, that's FRIEDMAN.com. And the new book is Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. It's listed on Amazon. You can get it from me through PayPal at my website or whatever. And it ranked, the rankings change a little bit. First in UFO books sales, the next day it's second, the next day it's third, then it goes back to first.
Well, I'm reading it now, and it's an excellent book, so I can highly recommend it.
Good. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being on the show. You've been absolutely wonderful. And I'd love to have you back sometime and tap your brain about, you know, all of this stuff.
My new book next year.
Oh, okay. What, you have a name for it yet?
Yeah, Flying Saucers and Science.
All right. Great.
It'll cover the whole waterworks, my magnum opus.
All right. Wonderful, Stan. Well, many thanks. And
thank you.
Keep up the great work.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Good night.
Bye-bye.